Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Today, two topics, and for both of them, we have a web page on our site dedicated to these topics. The first is kgov.com/300, the number 300, and that refers to the first 300 years of Christian history when our church fathers taught free will virtually with one voice, and they did not teach determinism, predestination, that all your decisions, all actions were set in advance. And then the second topic is kgov.com/incrementalism. We took artwork, the latest artwork from a brilliant guy, T. Russell Hunter, the founder of AHA, Abolish Human Abortion. And he has a meme that we've modified slightly. It says on it, pro-life incrementalism, and it's really something. You know a hamster wheel you have in a fish tank in your house with the hamster, and they get in there, and they run like mad, but they never get anywhere? So he has this great drawing of a hamster wheel, but in it, instead of a hamster, there's an elephant. Of course, because the elephant represents the Republicans. And so under it, it says pro-life incrementalism with the elephant running in place on the hamster wheel, the Republican wheel. And there's a little logo on the wheel itself, PLM, pro-life movement. And that's it. It is brilliant, but I added the word compromised to the meme. So it says pro-life compromised incrementalism. And we'll get to that. And we'll talk about the difference between compromised incrementalism against abortion and simply moral incrementalism. The compromised incrementalism are all the regulations that end with, and then you could kill the baby. And we're very familiar with them, the late-term abortion bans and fetal pain bills and all that. As long as you make sure you're not violating these regulations, then you could kill the baby. But the principled incremental laws are laws or other things you can do that do not save every baby from being killed, but they're not compromised morally. They are just. They're righteous. For example, if you go to an abortion mill and you're there protesting and you save a baby's life, in a way that's incrementalism. You saved one, but not all. But there are more direct examples. You might stop the funding of abortion. So doing that, that's not inherently immoral. It doesn't save all children, but you might succeed in doing that. You might pass a born-alive infant protection bill that does not mention abortion, and so it's not a regulation of child killing. In fact, you might abolish all abortion, and that's incrementalism, because in vitro fertilization clinics, where they routinely bring children into existence in a petri dish, in a test tube, and then kill them when they're not wanted and they're not performing an abortion. That's not the surgical or chemical killing of a baby in a pregnant mother's womb. So a typical abortion abolition bill allows for the killing of children at an in vitro fertilization clinic. And that's one reason that Colorado Right to Life, American Right to Life have supported personhood bills. Abortion abolition bills, they're perfectly moral and valid, even though in that way they're incrementalism. But personhood, identifying the personhood of the unborn child from the moment of fertilization, that's not incremental. That's a complete legal defense of every unborn child. And we want to get to that more thoroughly, but first, what did Christians teach up until the time of, let's say, St. Augustine or his mother's bishop, Ambrose? What did Christians teach overwhelmingly? At our website, kgov.com/300, you'll see the title of the show. This is from 12 years ago, and it has a really great written summary. It's Christians Taught Free Will for the First 300 Years. This came up in a number of our debates, including with James White, and he basically conceded this point. Also, it came up in my debate with D. James Kennedy's professor of New Testament, Dr. Samuel Lamerson. And in these debates, what I do, my approach, is to quote the Bible to defend my position. Because the fact that God is free and the future is open, it's not settled, that human beings are free, made in God's image and likeness, that position is defended on the scriptures, by the scriptures. When we are refuting our opponent's historical claims, then at times we reference extra-biblical sources. Now, our opponents, as in my debate with Dr. Lamerson, he obsessively referenced extra-biblical sources to defend his position. He couldn't stop himself. And late in the debate, this was a 10-round moderated debate. For him, it was like it was worse than being in purgatory. He thought he was the only Calvinist ever to go to hell. Late in the debate, he accused me of referencing extra-biblical sources, which is, you know how a leftist, they project whatever they're accusing you of is almost certainly what they're doing? And so Samuel Lamerson, he accused me of using extra-biblical sources, so I literally went through the entire debate. We had 48 hours between posts. I went through the entire 10-round, by that point it might have been 8-9 rounds, written debate, and I found that I had addressed, in defense of my position, I had addressed a single extra-biblical source, and that was the dictionary. That was it. Then I listed the extra-biblical sources that he appealed to defend his position, and there were dozens of them. I listed them all out. The title, the author, the creed, the council, and so on. It really was an experience. But when you hear the typical claim of Calvinists that they faithfully continue the teaching of the early church fathers, then in order to refute that, you typically have to appeal to history, extra-biblical sources. So that's what we've done at kgov.com/300. And there is a quote from a professor of historical theology at Oxford. His name is, you may have heard of him, Alistair McGrath. And he wrote a book in 1998 on the history of Christian doctrine. And in that book, and he is an Augustinian sympathizer, he's not an enemy of Augustine. But what he writes in this book, and we link right to it, you could read the quote in context. He writes, the pre-Augustinian, right, the Christian leaders and writers, the church fathers before Augustine. Augustine was, think about, you know, the late 300s, 400 AD. So the pre-Augustinian theological tradition is practically of one voice in asserting the freedom of the human will. How's that? From somebody who likes Augustine. So Alistair McGrath acknowledges that before Augustine, read all the church fathers, and there's a lot. There's a lot to read. They are practically of one voice in asserting The Freedom of the Human Will. One of my favorite books, God's Strategy in Human History, written by Marston and Forster. Their expanded 2000 edition. So great. But just like their original, shows that the early Christian leaders, and we link to this so you could see it, you could get the book yourself, or you could see, search it online. Early Christian leaders taught free will, and they rejected heresies that denied genuine free will. Scripture, and not church history, is authoritative on any debate over predestination and free will, of course. However, the observations, like in Marston and Forster's book, they include this incredibly valuable information for refuting the false claim that early Christian leaders opposed free will, genuine free will, what Calvinists often call libertarian free will. They supported genuine free will, and they opposed determinism. Now, when you get around to Martin Luther and John Calvin, what they thought wrongly, ignorantly, they thought that Augustine, who they admired in the extreme, they thought that Augustine was doing nothing other than affirming the teachings of the church for the previous 300 years. That's what they thought. And they were wrong. Now, determinism, while it was not taught in the first centuries of the Christian church, it was taught by the pagans. You know about the Greeks and go back before them, the Babylonians, back before them, the Sumerians, the Gnostics, the Neoplatonists, the Plato, Neoplatonists, the Stoics. They all taught determinism. Free will, on the other hand, was taught by the Christian leaders in the early cities where they focused on Christian thought, like in Alexandria, in Antioch, in Athens, in Carthage, Jerusalem, Lycia, Nysa, which is in Cappadocia, Rome, Sicca in Africa. So the Christian leaders in all those cities I just mentioned, they taught genuine free will. There were martyrs, sons of martyrs, who taught free will, including, and you could see their quotes explicitly in God's Strategy in Human History, all together in a single final chapter of the book. Those who taught free will included Justin Martyr, and not the fake kind of free will when you're debating a Calvinist who believes that you can only do that which you were eternally decreed to do. And you ask the Calvinist, do you believe in free will? And he says, yes. Right? That's what's called, there's a technical theological term for that. That's called a lie. And Dr. Samuel Lamerson, in the debate I had with him, he said he believed in free will. And so I challenged him. We're talking about the man who cheats on his wife, and he says, oh, yeah, he had free will to do that. Well, could he have not done that? No, he had no ability to not do that. That's his answer. So the church fathers who taught genuine free will included Justin Martyr. He died in 165 A.D. Irenaeus of Gaul, he died in 200 A.D. Athenagoras of Athens, he died in the 2nd century. Theophilus of Antioch, he died in the 2nd century. Tatian of Syria, he died in the late 2nd century. Clement of Alexandria, he died in 215 A.D. Bardazin of Syria, he died in 222 A.D. By the way, when we did this show, and you could get to it, just kgov.com/300, I read the quotes from each of these church fathers establishing beyond question that they affirmed genuine free will. Tertullian of Carthage died in 225. Origen died 254. Novatian of Rome died 258. Methodius of Olympus. He was martyred in 311 AD. By the way, in our Bible tours of Israel, Turkey, Greece, Italy, we've gone to so many of these locations. You could get some of those tours from our store. Just go to kgov.com, kgov.com. Click on the store in our Bible tours. Some of them we have teachings, we have video and so on, a Bible tour of Israel and others. I think you might really love them, especially if you're going to head out on such a trip. So, Arnobius of Sicca died 327 AD. Cyril of Jerusalem died 386. Gregory of Nyssa died 395. John Chrysostom died 407. Jerome died 420 AD. So again, you listen to kgov.com/300 and you'll hear all that. Now, actually, I read quotes from all of those except for the last five. We ran out of time. So let me do that right now, okay? Methodius of Olympus, here's what he wrote in a publication, The Banquet of the Ten Virgins, in chapter 16. He wrote this. Now, those who decide that man is not possessed of free will and affirm that he is governed by the unavoidable necessities of fate are guilty of impiety toward God. Isn't that something? How much more explicit can you be? Cyril of Jerusalem in Lecture 4, Section 18, know also that thou hast a soul self-governed, made after the image of its creator, having free power to do what it wills. Gregory of Nyssa, in a text titled On Virginity, chapter 12, being the image and the likeness of the power which rules all things, man kept also in the matter of a free will this likeness to God. And then John Chrysostom, on Hebrews, homily 12, quote, all is in God's power, but so that our free will is not lost, he does not precede our willing that our free will may not suffer. Isn't that interesting? Even when they're trying to distinguish between God's power, God could destroy the whole earth right now, bring everyone to judgment. And that doesn't violate anybody's free will. The most wicked person alive, if God kills them and brings them to judgment, that hasn't violated their free will. I hardly have met a Calvinist who could distinguish between your ability to do something and your will to do something. They simply cannot distinguish that. And to me, that suggests an unwillingness to distinguish because they're so obvious. And they'll say things like, well, you might will to be a millionaire. Well, yeah. Yeah, you will to be a millionaire. You may not have the ability to, but it doesn't mean you don't will to. Someone might will to be married to a particular individual, has no ability to accomplish that, but has the will. They can't distinguish, and they act like if you cannot accomplish something, then you cannot have the will to do that thing, and how absurd that is. So Jerome, in letters 123, these are all Roman numerals. He writes, we have been created, endowed with free will. This was a big topic, a controversy before Augustine. And the church, again, spoke with one voice against determinism and for genuine free will. So he writes, we have been created, endowed with free will. It is true that freedom of the will brings with it freedom of decision. Then we have Augustine, right? St. Augustine, who really turned things around. Now, his bishop was with him on this, his mother's bishop, Ambrose. But Augustine was the one who made this all, who turned everything upside down on its head and made the pagan teaching of determinism mainstream among Christians. Augustine admit it, and I link to this, in his writings, you could read it, that to explain the origin of evil, he would sacrifice any teaching at all, in order to preserve the Greek philosophical concept of utter immutability. That was the thing that was important to him. So Augustine, he repeats one of his favorite themes. This is in his book, Confessions. I refer to it as True Confessions. So one of his favorite themes is that God is unalterable and in no way changeable. Now, that's not biblical. God humbled himself. That's a change. God the Son became a man. That's a change. God the Son took on the sin of the world. That's a change. The Father poured out his wrath on the Son. That's a change. And so Augustine repeats what he gets from Plato, that God is unalterable and in no way changeable. Right? God doesn't change in his righteous character, but that doesn't mean that God, the Son, cannot become a man. That's a change. But Augustine believes that God is in no way changeable. And so he's struggling to understand the nature of sin. And Augustine wrote this on, quote, "What was the cause of evil? Whatever the cause might be, I saw that no explanation would do which would force me to believe the immutable God mutable." Now, do you get that? Do you get what he's saying? He was prepared to sacrifice any teaching at all in order to preserve immutability. So if the doctrine of God's righteousness, God is not the author of confusion. He's certainly not the author of wickedness, of perversion. If those doctrines have to be sacrificed in order to explain the cause of evil, well, then so be it, because the only doctrine I will not sacrifice is utter immutability, utter unchangeableness. And that is his, it was, he's no longer like this, that was his ultimate commitment to the pagan philosophical claim of utter immutability. And by the way, the foundation of Calvinism is not, as is often claimed, sovereignty, but instead it is utter immutability. So in that debate I had with this theologian who worked for D. James Kennedy, he was his professor of New Testament. So he wrote to me, Sam Lamerson, he writes to Bob, this is in post 3A of our Battle Royale 10, Is the Future Settled or Open? He writes, Bob, the cheating man does what he wanted to do. Simply because he could not have done otherwise does not mean that he did not freely choose to cheat on his wife. It's like, okay. I'm not a scholar. I'm just a talk show host. But to that I say, huh. So how about C.S. Lewis? Now, this is all extra biblical. We're using it to refute the claim that those Christians who are truly knowledgeable, that they believe in determinism and not free will. And of course, this is from 1960. So C.S. Lewis, I've read much, perhaps most of what he's written. This is from his broadcast talks. He said this, God created things which had free will. That means creatures which can go right or wrong. Some people think they could imagine a creature which was free but had no possibility of going wrong. But I cannot. If a thing is free to be good, it's also free to be bad. And free will is what has made evil possible. Why, then, did God give them free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. A world of automata, robots, of creatures that work like machines, would hardly be worth creating. The happiness which God designs for his higher creatures is the happiness of being freely, voluntarily united to him and to each other in an ecstasy of love and delight compared with which the most rapturous love between a man and a woman on this earth is mere milk and water. And for that, they've got to be free. Of course, God knew what would happen. I love how he writes this. Of course, God knew what would happen if they used their freedom the wrong way. Apparently, he thought it worth the risk. And that's the title of one of our favorite open theist authors, John Sanders. He wrote The God Who Risks, if I recall him as the author of that book. He thought it worth the risk. If God thinks this state of war in the universe a price worth paying for free will, that is, for making a real world in which creatures can do real good or harm, and something of real importance can happen, instead of a toy world which only moves when he pulls the strings, then we may take it, it is worth paying. I love it. An Oxford PhD is an expert on Augustine, although he's not a sympathizer. His name is Kenneth Wilson. He published a book this year, 2019, Proof, The Foundation of Augustinian Calvinism. Let me read this excerpt for you from page 94. Augustine was the only Christian bishop in history known to have been heavily influenced as a young man by participating in the three most highly deterministic systems that have ever existed: the Gnostics, the Neoplatonists, and the Stoics. Augustine's determinism did not come from the Apostle Paul, who had been a Pharisee who believed in free choice. Over 50 years before Augustine, Christian authors fought against those faded philosophies by teaching free choice. This new knowledge of how and why Augustine moved back into pagan determinism should greatly concern us. When these facts are combined with the knowledge that both Luther and Calvin mistakenly believed, and now this is along with countless Reformed pastors today, Luther and Calvin both mistakenly believed that Augustine was merely teaching what all the earliest church fathers had taught. Augustinian Calvinism is exposed as built upon an unstable foundation of pagan sand. Beginning with God is sovereign is not a Christian, but a Stoic foundation of philosophical theology. Wow, that's Ken Wilson, PhD in theology from Oxford. In fact, in 2012, he did his thesis on Augustine. So he's an expert on Augustine. This page, kgov.com/300, it has everything I've shared with you and about double that, a powerful historical rebuttal to the claim that the early church was Calvinistic. Powerful rebuttal. So you might want to check that out. Hey, this is Bob Benyart, kgov.com. This is Bob Benyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.